This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The Montgomery Biscuits make national news with their Millennial Night planned a couple weeks from now. We talk about that now on Tactics. Good morning. Welcome into Tactics. You're listening to us on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com on this Friday morning. Glad to be with you. And just so y'all know, a couple housekeeping things coming up. Will Dismukes, who is in the runoff for District 88 of the House of Representatives here in the state of Alabama, he's got an election coming up. Guys, keep in mind, and I probably haven't mentioned it enough, but the runoffs are coming up. That is actually next Tuesday. And I think I mentioned it a little bit, I think I mentioned it Wednesday, but keep that in mind that we actually do have a runoff election coming up. And there's some of them that I think you could kind of gauge as being not that important. Either we have a couple of really good candidates, and so the option doesn't make as much of a difference. But I do think that when it comes to these runoffs, there are a couple of them that I think are of utmost importance. And we really do need to get out and vote for those. There are some of them that the candidates are night and day. And so don't forget that Tuesday is an election day as well. But getting to our top story this morning, I've got to say, it has been a very amusing 24 hours in the news cycle. And I am actually kind of upset that I do not have... This is one of those mornings where I think I could easily do 3, maybe even 4 hours, depending on the amount of calls that I got. But the Montgomery Biscuits making national headlines this morning. The USA Today ran a story about them today. I don't know if it actually made it into their paper, but it was on their website. So I just thought that was hysterical. And here's what the whole thing centers over, because there was a huge controversy. A lot of people are deeply offended and upset and voicing their disdain with the Montgomery Biscuits online. It was all over Twitter. It was all over Facebook. If you have any kind of social media and you live in this area, you probably noticed that this popped up the other night. So the Biscuits are having Millennial Night, and that happens July 21st. So that would be not this upcoming Saturday, but I believe the next Saturday. And so this, they announced it. They had a big promotional stunt for it. And here is the headline from their social media post. This is from their Twitter and from their Facebook post. Want free things without doing much work? Well, you're in luck. Riverwalk Stadium will be millennial friendly on Saturday, July 21st, with a participation ribbon giveaway just for showing up, napping and selfie stations, along with lots of avocados. Oh, man, it's too good. This has been one of the most amusing things that I've seen in a long time. And I do want you to keep in mind throughout all this, and I'll probably mention this more than once, I'm a millennial. Typically, your millennials are people, it depends on the definition, depends on who you're asking, but just about everybody agrees that people born from about 1985 till right up until the 2000s, or maybe even up into 2005, that would be considered millennials. Some people have the cutoff for Generation Z, which is the generation after millennials, somewhere around the 2000s, so there may be a distinction there. But the point is, no matter how you swing it, no matter how you define it, I was born in 1989, so I'm clearly in the millennial camp, regardless of who you're asking. And I gotta say, I just thought this was absolutely hysterical. I mean, this popped up and I laughed, and I didn't get to see the live reactions of a lot of folks the other day because it'd been a long week and I went home and I didn't hang out with anybody or anything last night. But yesterday at work, the whole thing kind of blew up right not long after my show, actually. And we've got Joe Hunkin here, who he's about my age. Ben, who's also about my age, he's on WLWI on the weekends. And so it was the youngest members of the station that got together and were talking about this, and every single one of us just thought it was hilarious. And what might have been even more amusing about it is the social media fallout. There were some people that were really upset about this, and we'll get to that point by point in just a second. But I got to say, personally, I thought it was hysterical. Every millennial that I've talked to that has a decent sense of humor thought that it was hysterical, which I guess, honestly, this could be the litmus test for determining whether or not they have a decent sense of humor. But like any of my buddies, most of them baseball fans, they all thought this was really funny. And I got to say this, and this is my main thing that I will be upset with the Biscuits about if they don't handle this correctly. They had better deliver on those avocados, because I'm expecting maybe some gourmet guacamole available at the ballpark. I don't think that that's too much to ask. Maybe with the big Biscuits nachos that they've got there with the barbecue on them and everything, you have some guacamole served with that. You have some chips and guacamole. You know, I'm not the world's biggest avocado fan. I wouldn't say that I'm obsessed with them, but I do like a good bowl of guacamole for sure. And there's a couple of places that have a pretty good guacamole burger around here. I highly recommend them. You know, there's other burgers that I personally like better, but avocado, I'm a fan. I guess I fall into that millennial stereotype because of that, but they had better deliver on the guacamole. I want the guacamole when I go on Millennial Night, and I am going. I am really pumped up about that. I really want to go to this because I just thought this whole thing was just so funny. So as of last night, and I could probably go ahead and pull it up and give you a live update here, but I'm sure it hasn't grown too much because everybody's been asleep. Maybe some people who were getting on Twitter early in the morning. But as of last night, about midnight, when I was putting this segment together, let's see, they had 434 retweets, 410 replies, and 319 likes. Now, the comments, I would say, are maybe 70-30. So what you've got are about 70% of them are negative, about 30% of them are positive. But here's the thing. Even if that is true, that means that out of your retweets and replies combined, because a lot of people probably did both, that means that you've got roughly 400-ish retweets and replies, and if about 70% of those are negative, that means, you know, roughly 30% are either neutral or positive. And again, that's just a guesstimation. I don't have any real statistics on that. I always try to tell you when I'm using specific numbers and when it's just my observation, my guess. And so that means there's there's at least 100, 125 that would be what we would consider positive. And so you take that down, that means with about 900 likes, there's at least three times as many people that like this and responded to it than there are that disliked it, which I think bodes well for my generation, that there's several of us that have a good sense of humor. And one thing that I did notice is a lot of the nasty responses were from people that were not millennials and not baseball fans, which I think is funny. And you see this all the time. I have a lot of friends of mine that are baseball fans. I could name them off, but obviously y'all don't know who those people are. But my point is, I'm a baseball fan. I'm a baseball guy. I like it better than football or any of the other sports. And I have buddies. We probably went to at least three quarters of all the Auburn games when we were in Auburn, when we were students there. We went to all the Auburn baseball games. I mean, just big baseball fans. We would go right after class, hang out there. It was a great time. We went to so many games. And me and my fraternity brothers would be hanging out there. We didn't even necessarily plan. We didn't call each other and say, hey, let's go to a game. We just went to the game and we all just happened to be there. I mean, it was so common for us to go that there were people at the gate that knew us. And so big, big baseball fans. I know a lot of them. And every single one that I saw that has reposted this thought it was hilarious. Every single person that I saw that posted this or shared it or commented on it that I personally know that are friends of mine on Facebook or follow me on Twitter. Now, granted, I don't know all of them, but all the ones that I saw that were posting, you know, angrily about it, they were all people that were not going to go to a baseball game anyway. Now, I'm sure there's some exceptions. I'm sure you could point out some anecdotal evidence. I'm just saying from the people that I personally know, most of the people that are most mad about it are people that are either not millennials or not baseball fans, usually both. A lot of the folks that got mad were people that are a little bit older than millennials, and most of the millennials that I saw that did get upset about it were people that were not going to a Biscuits game anyway, or any other kind of baseball game for that matter. It was mostly young, hippie, and a lot of them were female. I'm just saying, that was my observation. There were some guys that were upset about it too, But the vast majority of the demographics that at least I was looking at is a lot of the people that were mad at it were people that have no interest in baseball whatsoever, would never have gone to a game regardless of how offended or not offended they were. Several of them mentioned that they had not even heard of the Biscuits, even though they came from the River region when they were younger. So this is not really, I see, a PR problem for the Biscuits. If anything, I think that it's helping them out. I thought this was a brilliant move from a PR standpoint from the Montgomery Biscuits and their front office, and I was actually talking to some of the guys in the front office this morning about this. I think it's great. I think it's spot on. I think it's really funny. I'd love to hear what you guys think about this, because I know I've got some millennials out there, certainly more than any other talk show host on political talk radio here in the River region. So I know my millennial audience is a little bit bigger than most. So I'd love to hear if you're a millennial, call in. If you're not a millennial, I mean, you've probably got kids or grandkids that are, feel free to call in 860-1440. Love to hear your ideas about this, your response, whether or not you think this was a good move by our very own Montgomery Biscuits. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back.
Okay.
Okay, here's the plan.
The Montgomery Biscuits make national news with their Millennial Night planned a couple weeks from now. We talk about that now on Tactics.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be. Sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com, 860-1440. That's the way to get in touch with us if you want to do so. I'm actually kind of surprised. I really thought that this was going to draw in more calls, but 860-1440, if you want to talk about it, I'm going to talk about it whether y'all do or not. No, I'm kidding. I do have another segment planned on this because just looking at a live update, they've actually gotten more than 1,000 likes now on Twitter. And there are a lot of comments, some of them positive, but a lot of them negative. And I do think that, unfortunately, in a lot of things, as it is with this and as it is just in general, that the people that are negative are the ones that want to speak up and want to speak the loudest. And again, like I've noticed, a lot of the comments and a lot of the replies are people that don't even live in the Montgomery area, that are not baseball fans and have no intention of ever going to a game. And so most of the people who were offended were the ones that just there was no chance they were going to wind up going to a Biscuits game in the first place. For a lot of them, I'm sure there might be some exceptions, but I just thought this was really funny. Now, some of the comments that I've seen, and I'm not going to read them exactly, because a lot of them are profanity lay, so I'm just going to just give you the general idea of some of the criticism that they've gotten and kind of address that. One was, you're going to alienate all of your potential future fans. Well, I'm pretty sure that a lot of the people, like I've already alluded to, that were offended by this were never really going to become fans. And because part of the thing is, when it comes to baseball, you don't really become a fan. Baseball is, with a few rare exceptions, that's something that's passed down from father to son. There's not a lot of people that didn't have any family connection to baseball that all of a sudden just wind up getting into baseball. It's more of a family-oriented thing, and that's the way that the sport is. And again, I'm sure that you could find exceptions to this, but by and large, one of the biggest determining factors, there are two determining factors, and Major League Baseball actually did a study on this not long ago. The two main factors that determine whether you are a baseball fan right now, as opposed to other people that are not baseball fans, is A, did they like baseball? If your parents like baseball, your odds of liking baseball are astronomically higher. And also, did you play as a kid? Because generally speaking, people that played when they were in Little League or in high school, those are the main things that determine whether or not you are a baseball fan later in life. And so there's very few people that just all of a sudden go, I think I'll just watch a few baseball games and see if I can get into it. That just really doesn't happen. You get some of that with NASCAR, you get some of that with basketball and some of the other major sports. You really don't get that with baseball. Baseball is very family-oriented, and usually it's passed down from father to son, from parent to child, however you want to say it. And when it comes to baseball itself, if you didn't play it, you're probably also not a fan. And so, really, there's just very few people that become baseball fans. And another thing, too, I'm guessing that those guys that are upset about this, the ones that are deeply offended, are probably way too busy watching some communist sport like the World Cup and reruns of The Office on their parents' Netflix account. That's probably what they're more worried about doing. I don't think that they're going to be coming out to any Biscuits games anytime soon. And some people say, Caleb, that was a stereotype. Well, yes, it is. Moving on. So they'll say, this is why baseball is an old and dying sport. Actually, I see a lot of younger people at baseball games. When I go to a Biscuits game, it's a lot of young people. I mean, there's some old folks, too. You get some gray heads, and we love our Golden Biscuits. I know they have the Golden Biscuits promos. And that's great. I love hanging out with older baseball fans. There's a lot of history there. There's a lot of stories that they can tell you. I'd typically go with my dad and granddad. And it's something that has been generational in our family. But the truth is, when I do go, there's a lot of younger people there, a lot of kids with younger kids. I know that there's a lot of people my age that have talked about going. I've gone with friends that are my age over and over again. So when it comes to this kind of stuff, the idea that it's just an old and dying sport, here's the thing. There's some truth to that. First of all, when you're talking about Major League Baseball, a lot of the fans are older. And whether you're talking about watching it on TV or actually going to a game, a lot of the fans there are older. You don't see a ton of millennials going to those baseball games. But the thing is, with minor league actually does okay with younger people. Younger people are far more willing to drive down to their local ballpark and spend an evening there. So minor league does okay with people that are younger. Here's another one. This is going to put the Biscuits out of business. Well, just a few seconds ago, these same people were saying that millennials don't go to baseball games. So you got to pick one. Either this is going to offend all their fans and the Biscuits will be put out of business, or millennials don't go to baseball games anyway. You got to pick one or the other. You can't say that this is going to be putting the Biscuits out of business and at the same time claim, well, they don't have any fans that are millennials. Well, you got to pick one or the other. I don't think that this is going to hurt their business at all, personally. But the argument makes absolutely no sense. Another one that I saw criticism over and over again is like, it's not right to stereotype an entire generation of people as lazy or not hardworking. Where in that statement did they say that millennials were lazy? I'm reading through it. I don't see it. Now, they did mention napping stations. And they did mention want free stuff without working too hard for it, which is kind of a stereotype that a lot of millennials have been put. But that doesn't mean that millennials are being called necessarily lazy. I really do think that there are people that, and I've said this 100 times before on different issues, I think that there are people that just continuously prowl the internet looking for something to be upset by. I think that that is exactly what is going on right here. Another criticism, this is because their whole PR department is a bunch of old white guys. Yeah, here's the thing with that. I know a lot of the Biscuits front office because of our relationship with them. Of course, they're over on our sister station, Sports Radio 740. They used to be here on News Radio 1440, and back when they were, I was one of the guys that ran the board for them during their game. So I have a much more personal relationship with the Biscuits than the average Montgomeryan. And I've had, you know, guys like Murph and Scott come into the show, and we have the Biscuits show that comes on Saturdays. Never been on with them, but because of that, I see them pretty much every Saturday, you know, when they're doing the show. And so I see them on a weekly basis because of that. And I got to tell you, you look at the Biscuits front office, it's almost entirely millennials. Not saying 100%, and there are some people that are kind of in that gray area where you're not really sure if they're the millennial or the generation beforehand, but my point is just about everybody is under 40. You don't have a lot of middle-aged guys running the Biscuits. And the people in the marketing department, not the PR department as they're saying, but in the marketing department that probably came up with this, I know the guy that's in charge of all that stuff. And he's not much older than I am. These are the guys that play on our video game nights, that come out and hang out with us when we're doing our video game streams. I mean, these are not a bunch of old fogies. I know that that's what every millennial thinks. Well, if there's someone making a joke about millennials, it must be some old guy that just doesn't understand, man. But that's not what's going on here at all. This decision and this promo was thought up by a bunch of millennials. See, the difference is they have a sense of humor about themselves. The people that are complaining about it online don't. And that's really the problem that I have with this entire thing. In fact, the millennials, the Biscuits actually responded on Twitter, which I thought was just golden. They said that this is the quote from the tweet that they replied to their own tweet. Offended? Feel free to fight your battles IRL and visit us in Riverwalk Stadium. Any millennial that actually comes by during office hours before next Saturday and submits a valid complaint in person to our Millennial Night think tank may get a free ticket or two. So, again, the Biscuits just kind of trolling the people that are upset with them, which I thought was hilarious. A lot of people were even more offended by this response, which, again, those were the people that probably weren't going to wind up showing up to a Biscuits game anyway. And what I find ironic about this whole thing is one of the jokes made in this tweet is that millennials are easily offended. And millennials played into that stereotype by getting offended that it was suggested that millennials are too easily offended. I don't know, just the level of irony, you could cut the irony with a knife here. And what's funny is that the people that are outraged about this, they don't see it. They don't understand why it's so funny. It's funny because of people like them that get offended at every little thing. That's the whole joke. So them getting offended by it only makes the joke funnier. I really do think that this goes back to what I was saying, though. There are people that are just addicted to outrage. They have to get on the internet. They have to look for what they can be upset about to get their daily fix of outrage. Guys, have a sense of humor about yourselves. I thought this was hilarious. Just because somebody makes a joke that's somewhat at your expense does not mean the joke is not funny and doesn't mean you can't laugh at it. This is why it's so hard to have fun nowadays, is because every little thing you do, you have to worry about it being scrutinized. It's really a bigger problem with comedy as a whole, and we'll get to that in just a second. 860-1440, really love to hear what some of y'all have to think about this. I know that there's a lot of Biscuits fans out there, a lot of people that are listening to me that go to the ball games. I want to hear your reactions to it, positive or negative. Love to hear what you have to say. 860-1440, we'll be back in just a second.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
Colossians 3:17, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with us if you have a desire to do so. And let's actually jump to the phones. Let's go to line one. John from Millbrook is waiting for us. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, first of all, I wanted to help you define what a millennial is.
Yeah.
A millennial is a kid. And a kid is anybody that wasn't in school when I had my first child.
That's an interesting loose definition of millennial there.
Well, yes, because it's based on everyone's point of reference. And so, Joe's a kid, you're a kid. anybody under 35 pretty much is a kid.
Yeah. Well, actually, generally speaking, millennials age out right around that time. So, Joe's an older millennial. And yeah. So, actually, even though that you're, like I said, it's kind of a loose definition of what millennial is, that's pretty close to accurate. Now, the people that are coming up now that are around the 18 to 20 age right now, those are typically considered the next generation, Generation Z. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, that generally speaking, that is what people think of as a millennial.
Well, one of the things that's a problem, and I have a lot of experience with millennials, more than most. Watch them grow up, watch them, interacted with them. Know a lot about I don't know everything about them, of course. I didn't try to know everything about them. But I've had more experience with young people than most do.
Well, over your career, you've probably taught, at least 1,000 or two?
No, yeah, at least, yeah. No doubt. But part of the problem is we've educated our young people to be sensitive. Growing up, I didn't know I was supposed to be, so I never paid any attention to it.
Right.
We knew what a bully was. Because normally what that meant was you were getting a frog in the back or a bruise on your arm or something like that, and there was extortion along the way trying to take money from you and things like that. We didn't report that kind of stuff. We just manned up and learned how to deal with it. And we had to overcome that by demonstrating some courage and standing up to someone. Well, that's the problem that we have with a lot of the millennials. They want to cry to somebody, because something isn't going their way and someone's trying to take their milk money.
Well,
sometimes
you gotta
be Opie and fight back.
Yeah, that is a great episode of Andy Griffith, by the way. But one thing that I think that this whole episode really shows is it's funny that the stereotype plays itself out in the form of how they reacted to it.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like,
oh, I know exactly what you mean, because
there are a lot of
their own point.
Right. A lot of the millennials that saw this, they had a sense of humor about it, laughed about it, clicked like, moved on with their lives, and didn't let it bother them for the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so several of those people, like myself, probably liked it enough that they plan on going down to the ballpark when this event takes place next Saturday. But I don't know, it just bothers me that there's a large swath of my generation that can't take a joke.
Yeah. And one of the things to be able to get through life is to be able to laugh at yourself.
Absolutely.
If you can't do that, and everyone has to be able to do that, no matter who you are, they're not protected people. Everyone needs to understand their strengths, but also their weaknesses, and they need to understand those differences that are going to be pointed out about others, and since they are going to be, how to handle it in a humorous way.
Well, here's the thing. There is a line, and I think that there's a line that you can cross to where it's no longer funny, but this was about as mild a joke as you could possibly come up with.
Yeah.
And they said, well, it's a stereotype. Well, stereotypes are funny. That's part of what makes them stereotypes. I mean, think about it. Any joke that has ever been made about a group of people, whether it was race, age, whatever, the joke is funny because it fits the stereotype. When you make old people jokes, the reason those jokes are funny is because it fits a certain stereotype. It plays on something that you know to be a common characteristic of the group. And I mean, look at us. We do take more naps than the average person. We do like avocados more than most folks. I mean, everything fits.
Because it's true. Yeah, there's some truth to it.
If it weren't true, it wouldn't be funny.
That's like a cliche. A cliche is that because most of the time it was pretty clever when it was started.
Right. And so
that's why it's used over and over again.
And I just think that's really the point. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. You have a good one. Thank you, John from Millbrook. Always insightful. This is really one of the big issues. I tell you what, we'll do this when I come back. Because I'm a little bit over break, I do need to run to a commercial break. We'll talk about this a little bit more. I think that this is a perfect example, and this is just sort of a microcosm of a larger issue that's going on in our country. Political correctness has killed, and I mean killed, comedy. It's gotten to the point to where you can't really even make a joke anymore. We'll talk about that in just a second when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com, 860-1440, if you want to weigh in. And we got Will Dismukes coming at the top of the hour. He will be in here at 10 o'clock. And before we do get back to the story that we were talking about, I wanted to mention this because I do think that this is really important, and I'm just now getting this information. A listener actually sent this to me just now. It's a release for the Montgomery Fire and Rescue Celebration Parade, which will be going on today from 10:30 to 2. It will be celebrating 120 years of the dedicated service to the city of Montgomery. So something to honor our brave men and women that keep us safe with fire and rescue. And they do a lot more than just fire and rescue, of course. They're usually the first ones on the scene when it comes to a medical emergency. And I mean, just when it comes to our first responders, we really have to do everything that we can to support them. That's an issue that I feel really passionate about. I know a lot of you do too. So this parade is going to be going on. Let's see, do they have a location? I reckon it's going to be at Madison Avenue, at 19 Madison Avenue, the parade, where vehicles will remain on display as they present a short ceremony, which will begin at 11:30, followed by a complimentary lunch. So, sounds like a really great event. I don't think I'll actually be able to get out for it because I'll still be stuck here at work. But the point is, if you do want to go, that would be something that is really cool, 120 years of service to the Montgomery area. And I just wanted to say, kind of on that note, thank you to all of the people that are our first responders, our fire and rescue, and of course our first responders, our police officers, paramedics, EMTs, that kind of thing. Thank you so much for all you do for our community and keeping us safe. Now, back to the subject at hand that we were talking about, it made national news, was in USA Today, that the Montgomery Biscuits put forward this press release for Millennial Night, which is coming up this Saturday, not tomorrow, Saturday, a week from now. And there was all this backlash on Twitter. People got offended. And here's the thing. And I hate to say this, but comedy is dying. Comedy is dying because politically correct culture killed it. And just a few examples here. Millennials have gotten all upset at Friends because they're going back through Netflix and watching Friends, and they're saying that some of the jokes are homophobic or not politically correct, which I think Friends has got to be one of the funniest shows that there's ever been. They're saying stuff, getting upset at stuff like when it came to Ross. There was one joke where Ross is talking about Rachel, and he says, well, if she's going to be dating other guys, and then I am too. And then they all just kind of stare at him. He's like, oh, ha-ha, Ross is gay. And so, I mean, it's just stuff like that that they're getting upset about. It's harmless stuff. And, I mean, if you're going to talk about a show, even though I don't agree with this, Friends was very pro-gay. They had an actual lesbian wedding and had an entire episode devoted to it. So, I mean, just the idea that people aren't sensitive enough today. Late night, I mean, late night has gotten horrible. You look at Fallon, Conan, especially Jimmy Kimmel. And I love Conan. I used to be a huge Conan fan, would stay up late just to watch him, even though he came on after Leno. And I gotta say, I can't watch it anymore because it's nothing but leftist virtue signaling. It's not even jokes. The other night, for example, this is just one example of it. When Jimmy Fallon had Trump on, there was a lot of blowback from people on the saying that he wasn't mean enough to Trump and he should have been more forceful with Trump. And he actually came out and apologized for it and said, I'm sorry for humanizing him. Did you want to treat him inhumanely? Is that the approach you thought you should have taken? Like, it's just gotten ridiculous. We're not allowed to have fun with ourselves anymore. You know, and a lot of these, the problem with in a lot of ways is that a lot of these comedians have gotten to the point to where they're emphasizing politics and the political message over comedy. You can look at this with Kathy Griffin with the severed head. That's not funny. Nobody thought that was funny. You can look at the whole thing with Michelle Wolf. Half the stuff that she said wasn't even jokes. It was just political messaging. I mean, the end of her monologue was, and Flint doesn't have clean water. That's not a joke. Even people on the left wouldn't find that funny. It's just a statement. And so, really, this political correct culture is killing it. And I hate that because comedy used to be a lot better. Like, look at Dana Carvey. Dana Carvey's known for his political humor. He does impersonations of different presidents going back to, Reagan and Bush and H.W. Bush and Obama. And you can tell that he's on the left. You can tell that he likes Obama better than he does a lot of the other presidents. But, I mean, dang it, it's funny. It's not mean-spirited. It's just good humor. And that's because he puts the comedy first, the political message second. Blazing Saddles, for example. Nobody would touch Blazing Saddles nowadays. You cannot tell me that there is a movie studio in the country that would look at the script of Blazing Saddles and say, yeah, we'll make that movie. Blazing Saddles is one of the funniest movies ever. And it is because, at the end of the day, the message is actually that the black guy winds up being the hero. Which is, you know, fine, but it's all the buildup is funny. That humor would not be allowed if it were made today. Mel Brooks even said that. He said that there's no way that they would make Blazing Saddles if I was trying to get a studio to pick it up today, and he's right, which is a shame because it's hysterical. One of my favorite movies, actually. I'll say this about it. One of the exceptions to this rule, one place where one person that has not bowed down to political correctness, even though he happens to be on the left, and I'll give him credit for this, Bill Maher. Bill Maher does not buy into the whole political correct garbage. He even said when there were these stories coming out of millennials getting upset with watching an episode of Friends and saying that it's not woke enough, he said, look, you can't be upset with somebody not being woke before woke was a thing. Which, by the way, using the word woke is not okay unless it's done in ironic fashion. Like, if you're using it to make fun of somebody, I totally get it. But if you're using woke and not sensing the irony in that, or you're using woke and being dead serious about it, I can't take you seriously after that. So the whole thing is, you can move forward with comedy, and it doesn't necessarily have to be political messaging. Now, on my show, it's primarily politics, so I stick to politics. I might work in a little bit of humor here and there. But if you are a comedian and comedy is your goal, that should be first and politics should come second. Hour 2 coming up with Wills' Mukes.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Wildis Mukes, a candidate for District 88 of the state of Alabama House of Representatives, is here with me. We go there now on Tactics. Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. You are back in the Situation Room for Hour 2 of Tactics, and we do have a guest who we're going to go to right now. He is running for District 88 of the Alabama House of Representatives, and he is in the runoff right now. So made it to the runoff. Congratulations, Wildis Mukes. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me this morning, Caleb, and it's always an honor to be on your show, and I really enjoyed it last time, and I've been looking forward to the opportunity this time.
Well, you know, the reason you made it to the runoff in the first place is because you were on my show, so.
Oh, it had to be. Kidding. I mean, we established that the first time.
I think we did actually talk about that, if I'm not mistaken.
I think we did.
But, you know, I have to use the same jokes over and over again because I'm not that creative. But anyway, great to see you again. I know that we ran into each other at countless campaign events over the span of the campaign, and I wanted to just give you a chance to talk about it. I've reached out to your opponent. He's welcome to come on. Any of the people that are, and I've said this for weeks now, anybody that's in one of the runoffs is welcome to come on anytime. We will make time for you. But I know that one of your big issues, and I remember that you were really passionate about this the last time you talked to me. I think we've discussed this just about every time we've run into each other, is I know that you're really big on education funding.
Right, that's right.
And this is one of your key issues. I was wondering, because I don't think I've ever asked you about this before, which really surprised me in retrospect. I think that the voters would be interested in this. Would you be in favor of a plan to combine the education fund and the general fund?
Yeah, I really would. And, you know, I can't give you some specifics exactly how that needs to happen or work, but I really would like to see us combine. I may have said that on the first show. I know on one of the radio programs I've been on, I stated I think I would like to see them both combine. Instead of having two appropriation bills, I think it would be great to see you have one or one budget instead of two separate budgets. So I think there could be some advantages there. And, you know, I'm sure there's been some good arguments to disadvantages. But I can't remember exactly how many states still have two budgets. You may know, Caleb, but there's not that many.
Not off the top of my head.
Still operate off two separate budgets. And so I would like to see us combine and go to one budget. Another thing I really wouldn't mind seeing is I think we're one of three states that still has elections for superintendents, and Autauga County and Elmore County are just one of, like, it's less than 20 counties, I believe, in the state of Alabama that still elect superintendents, and I personally wouldn't mind seeing us try to move to an appointed superintendent.
Well, now, what's the advantage of an appointed superintendent over an elected one?
So they actually have to do something in their job year-round, and they're not just trying to really light the fire the last year before re-election. I'm not saying there's not some great elected superintendents, and I'm not personally knocking the two superintendents in my district. Mm-hmm. I just think that you know, that there's a little more accountability there, because as it stands now, if I'm not mistaken, if let's say that your superintendent is doing a terrible job and you say, hey, it's time for you to pack up and leave, if he's elected, he still draws out his salary because he's elected, you know. And so let's say in year two, you know, he's still got two more years, he's going to be drawing drawing the salary. And I think the amount of money that we're paying our superintendents across the board, I think there needs to be 100% accountability there for them. And I think that that we could really help that if they know, like, hey, if you don't do your job, you know, you're gone. It's not going to come down to, you know, whether you're popular or you're not popular, or, you know, the last year of the election you push some things. So,
well, and there is a bit of a trade-off. Some people would argue that elections do keep them more accountable, but it only keeps them accountable at certain times.
Right.
And so that's really the issue that you're running into. It's the same issue that we have with elected officials that we may not necessarily like, is that we don't have the opportunity to knock them out of office until an election year actually does come up.
Right.
And so it really does depend on that. I was actually kind of surprised that you took that stance on it. I figured you'd take the opposite approach. But nonetheless, I mean, good points, I thought, with several advantages. When it comes to combining the budgets, one thing that I kind of wanted to ask as a follow-up, because a lot of people would say, yeah, that would give us a lot more flexibility and it may even help education funding, but the issue is going to be with the way that the state allocation, because we're required to give a certain amount to federal programs, mm-hmm. like Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And so wouldn't that eat up the education fund and we actually might wind up with less education funding as a result?
So, yeah, there would have to be a lot of really good planning. And I think the problem is you've got to have 140 people that can all get along and see how we could make sure that, you know, your Medicaid funding didn't interfere with your education money, and, you know, and you've got things that are earmarked and things that are available to spend. And I mean, you know, there's so many working components that I don't know that it would be easy, but I think it's achievable with the right minds that can get together and really work on it as one. You know, it's just, you got 35 senators and 105 House members that, you know, some of them have what, you know, their own agendas and how they want things, and some want one and some want two. And so it just, I think, comes down to what would be the best for the state of Alabama and having those people come together and be willing to work together.
Well, I mean, there are some issues there, because you might have some people that don't prioritize education spending,
right.
And because of that, they'd rather allocate those funds that would normally be used for education somewhere else if the budgets are combined. And I'm not stating my stance on one side or the other,
yeah.
But I mean, that is a trade-off that is going to have to be considered.
That's right. And I don't think right now our education system, I mean, if you look across the state of Alabama, is struggling. I mean, you know, in our numbers across the nation and our numbers in counties, my district that I'm in, you know, our education funding where I'm at is low per student, you know, and we're trying to do different things. And hopefully through relationships that I can build with the school boards and with the superintendents, and, you know, they can really enlighten me on issues, and I can continue learning from some of the teachers that I know that with those relationships, I can help from the state level to improve and be able to be a voice for education in my county, you know, at the state level and across the state of Alabama. But, yeah, our education system's struggling right now, and I don't think we can afford to give up money to another program. And, you know, it's like, well, we can't. I mean, I just don't think we can borrow money from education to move it over to something, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, and that sort of thing. I think that we've got to hold our ground for education and figure out ways to improve it rather than take from it.
So you're saying that is a potential pitfall, but one that you think can be managed.
Yeah, I think it can be managed. I think it can be overcome. It's just whether or not people really want to spend the time and the work and do what's right to put it all together.
Now, you're asking us to put our faith in a bunch of politicians that they'll
yeah.
do what's right. So you do realize that.
That's
okay. Just making sure.
Yeah, that's why. You know, that's one thing about me is, like, I can look at things from both sides. Like, I could sit there and argue about the electing a superintendent over appointing one, you know, and I can argue that point too. And so I can certainly, I think that's one thing about you and I is we can look across views and, you know, we can make points on both sides of them. So.
Sure. One thing that I wanted to ask you about is, because just like any other government program, there's always going to be waste. There's always going to be some issues that you come into with money not going to where it needs to be. So when it comes to education specifically, are there some areas that you could see that maybe we could cut back on? Maybe we could save some money here and there and use that money more effectively and allocate it in a way that will be more beneficial to the students and to the people of Alabama?
You know, I really don't have a specific. I've reached out to a few different people to try to get some areas of concern, you know, and I know I've said it before, is the school book issue, that we don't have enough school books, you know, in the classrooms. And I just saw a statistic the other day. I can't remember who cited the statistic, who did the program and the study, but it was saying that it's proven that actual hard copy books are showing to be more successful in learning than, you know, some of the other techniques of learning, like Prattville's making copy paper lessons, you know, because they don't have enough books. So I really don't have a specific area at this point, because I've reached out to several people and I haven't been able to get a whole lot of feedback on it. So I'm hoping once I get in there, you know, I'll have access to start doing some extra digging and start tearing back some layers and looking to see what we can really cut out and where we can reappropriate things or cut that waste out and actually apply it to what we need to apply it to.
All right. Well, we're actually going to go to a break here in just a second. We've been talking a lot about education, but there's a couple things that are in the general fund area, one on taxes specifically that I want to ask you about. So Will Dismukes, he is running for District 88 of the House of Representatives. I know there's a lot of people within the sound of my voice, our listening audience, that's in his district. So we'll be back with more and ask him a few more questions. If you want to ask a question or pose one to me, 860-1440 is the way to do that. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Gosh, I am glad that these mics are not on during the commercial break. Will Dismukes and I, he's in the studio with me. We're having a good time joking around with one another. Now, Will, I've been asking a lot about education, but one thing that I did want to ask you about, and by the way, we should mention for those of you who are just now joining us, he's a candidate for District 88. So if you're in District 88, he is up for the runoff, which will be taking place on Tuesday, and it will be him in the runoff on July the 17th. So if you want to vote for him, if you like what you hear here, that would be where to go and to vote for him. Now, would you support eliminating the state's income tax and taxing through alternative means, like maybe going straight to a fair tax or a sales tax, taxing, you know, some other kind of way? Would you be in favor of getting rid of the income tax?
No, not the state income tax. I'm not saying that there's not some kind of changes that we can make, but right now I would say I would probably be in favor of leaving the state income tax. You know, now federal income tax, maybe a little different story, but you know, I guess, like, I think is it Florida that what kind of tax is it? One of them doesn't have, they just go off sales tax or property tax, and they don't have.
Well, there's a few states that do that. Texas is one.
Okay.
Yeah, Texas doesn't have a state income tax. It's just sales tax.
I'll be honest, though, that's the first time I've ever been asked that question. But you know, unless there's just some really great plan that's really, really good, I mean, I would probably leave it in place as it is. But like I said, now if I had some opinion time on something that really I don't, you know, that's out of my opportunity to voice my opinion on, a federal income tax, maybe a little different story.
But. Yeah, well, you're going to have to get into a completely different election.
That's
to have
right.
Me say so over that.
That's right.
But yeah, it was just something that I proposed because and I'm not necessarily making the case to you, I'm just explaining where that question's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the most prosperous states in the country, they have several factors that are going for them, including like abundant natural resources, enough agricultural produce enough agricultural product produced inside their state that it would allow them to fend for themselves, water resources, that kind of thing. And Alabama has every single one of these factors with the exception of one, and that is those states that are doing really well don't have a state income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not necessarily somebody that is against income tax outright,
mm-hmm.
but I don't like the idea of sales tax and income tax.
Right.
Like, pick one or the other,
yeah,
in my opinion.
But not both.
Right.
And that makes sense.
Because I think Delaware has no sales tax, but they have a heavier income tax. So,
yeah.
And so there's some states that just make it work the other way. But, you know, that's just my opinion on it. But I was just wondering if maybe you'd ever thought of that or would it support legislation to do that?
No, that's the first time that has ever been asked me and even crossed my mind was about going to one or the other, you know, not having both.
Mm-hmm.
I will say in the fourth grade, I still remember my mom was actually my fourth grade Alabama history teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I got a paddle in every day. But but I still remember us studying and there was a fact in the book that you could put a wall. This was before the popularity of the border wall, by the way. You could build a wall around the state of Alabama, and you know, you look at our natural resources, and you know, we have a beach, and we have, you know, the foothills, and you know, all these sorts of things. I mean, you could put a fence around Alabama, and we could sustain ourselves. You know, we've got car manufacturers, and I know there's a whole lot you can add and argue to that, but for the most part, if you really look at the state of Alabama and what we have to offer, I mean, it's just almost unlimited with the resources that we have. I mean, you drive around Tuscaloosa, we've got oil, you know, we've got oil wells up there. So
right, we have them in Tuscaloosa, and of course, we have them on the Gulf as well.
That's right, out in the Gulf.
There's really no reason, in my opinion, that Alabama should not be one of the top tier states in the country.
I agree.
But anyway, so last time we were here, I remember that you said that you were in favor of cutting funding in areas where money was being wasted, but you said that there weren't any specifics that you had in mind. You had a little time to do some research on that. You've gotten a little more familiar with the issues. Is there anything specifically that you can think of where we could maybe scale back some on the budget?
Yeah, you know, I tell you what, I may come under a little heat of this, but I think we need to further look in our entitlement programs. I think we really need to evaluate on our Medicaid and different things like that. And Medicaid's such a hot topic because we're pushed constantly to raise it and all these sorts of things. And I think we need to look into our welfare programs and all that, and we need to see who is abusing the system. And if they're abusing it, then we need to cut it out. You know, and so I think there's definitely some areas there where there's a lot of waste going that we could really trim down and that we could cut out. And so that's probably one of the areas where I would start. And it has nothing to do with, you know, my view on people. You know, I understand people fall on hard times, but there comes a point where you are literally taking advantage of the system. For instance, I had a girl tell me one day that I knew. She's a friend of ours, and I was complaining about, you know, I'm blessed that I can complain about this, but my little boy was on formula, and it was costing us, I think it was $83 a week was the formula he was having to use and all that. And I mean, you start adding that
and
up.
You can feed me on $83.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it's never going to end. Well, she said, I get the same thing for free. She said, why don't you just go sign up for WIC? And, you know, you can get it for free. Now, she was driving a sports car, had a nice home and all this, but she, because of the way that she had her, I don't know whether you say assets or living situation covered up or whatever, you know, she was able to get, she's getting all this money for food and all this money, you know, free baby formula, and she's getting extra money for having a child while I'm paying for having a child, you know, throughout the months of the year and all these different sorts of things. And it's like, it's completely abusing the system. And if one person's doing it, I mean, we all know that more of it's going on.
Well, and sure, so. And that's the thing. Even I think the most liberal of liberals would say, well, the welfare program isn't designed for people that can provide for themselves.
Right.
And so I think that there's definitely some measures that we could take on that. Now, had you been in office at the time, and I know that you weren't, but how would you have voted on the retail tax expansion? You know that that came up with the expanding tax on retailers, especially third-party vendors like on Amazon. Would you have voted in favor of that expansion?
So I think it comes into effect August 1st, if I'm not – are we talking about the same one?
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, and
– I'd have to look up the date again, honestly.
So just as of recently, I believe I heard maybe you talking about it, and somebody on talk radio was talking about it. And so I reached out to a few business owners, and a lot of them made really good cases as to why we needed it, and compared to the disadvantage of not having it. And they were claiming that, you know, that they were losing a lot of business to online and people being able to avoid the taxes and all that sort of thing.
So. Well, now statistically that's untrue, just because they did a study about it and they found out that in states that have online retail taxes versus states that do not, it did not really affect brick and mortar businesses, but about 10% of their sales. And of that 10%, roughly half of it, they just went to other websites to avoid the taxes. So you're looking at like maybe 5%. Of that overall in online sales, which is, I mean, it has some impact for sure, but it's pretty
minuscule. Not a major impact.
Right.
I know, when, you know, it's kind of funny because it's like,
because I mean, you don't go to Amazon. It's like, well, I could get this at, you know, Walmart or wherever else, but if I go on Amazon, I can avoid the taxes. People don't make the decision
right
based on that.
But you know, they could, I guess maybe they could potentially, there are some people that will make that decision that are like, well, I'll just go here or there, you know, if it's equal. But a lot of people shop online to avoid the hassle of going in the store.
Right, it's a convenience decision.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't really do a lot of online shopping. However, you know, Amber, my wife, she buys a lot of Pratt stuff offline and things like that. So,
sure.
You know, as nice as it is to be able to avoid some of that taxes, I guess we're going to have to be paying it.
Okay, so you would have supported the expansion, in other words.
Yeah, I believe I would have supported it. And that's based off of the conversations that I have had with local business owners. That's not going off of just, you know, necessarily my personal opinion, but
sure.
But off of the about the dozen different businesses that I talked to, you know, we're supposed to be looking out as a representative for the people of our state and our businesses and all those sorts of things. So,
all right. Now, a couple of days ago, this was in the news with the Associated Press. Governor Ivey recently called for the end of the practice of sending sheriffs to feed prisoners directly. But the thing is, that's going to actually take legislation to end. She can't just unilaterally end that practice, even though she made a statement about it and is making, you know, moves towards that. The legislature is eventually going to have to decide on that. And if you take office, you will be helping, you know, in that process. You'll be deciding that. So is that something you think you would be in favor of? You think it would be against? Does that need to be reformed?
Well, I tell you, there's at one point in time in history, that was a necessary fund, you know, because the sheriff had to supply the meals. Mm-hmm. And or when they were supplied, if there was a shortfall, he had a backup fund. Now, I don't think that's so much the case. But what I've heard a lot of the sheriffs say is, you know, based off of what all they do for the amount of money they make, you know, it's sort of like a reimbursement plan. You're talking about the backup fund. So, you know, I think there needs to be some reform there personally. I mean, you know, I just...
So what do you think that reform would look like?
I think that if we're supplying all the food, if like they're going to supply the food for the sheriff's department, and there's not a need for that extra funding, or to where they can control how much or how little is spent because they want to build up their thing, I don't really support that. Mm. I don't really see where that's really the right thing to do to be able to sort of have just this bonus fund put to the side. But you know.
All right, so you'd be in favor of
Governor Ivey's plan.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I just wanted to be sure on that because I, you know, you have to make it clear for everybody.
Oh yeah, yeah. I would be in support of Governor Ivey's plan.
Okay.
But because also, you know, the two sheriffs that are in my district, you know, I would encourage them to reach out to me and let me know why, you know, where this is truly beneficial other than being able to buy you know, a house at the beach.
Right, which unfortunately our sheriffs, we have had problems with not, when I say our sheriffs, I don't mean specifically Elmore and Autauga County. Actually, neither one of those were mentioned in some of the research that I've done, but there has definitely been abuse where there was specifically a sheriff that bought a beach house with the leftover money that he had.
And the former longtime sheriff in Autauga County, he has been one of the biggest supporters of mine. And I have to say, he's one of the finest people that I have ever known. And Sheriff Johnson, it just means the world to me and my family. I mean, I've known him my entire life. He and my grandfather were friends, and I love him to death. And you know, I've seen no change in the way he is in any sort of manner, and I love him to death, and I truly mean that. But you know, as far as the guy that bought the beach house, you know, that's interesting.
It's kind of a glowing example of why there might need to be some rethinking on this policy. But yeah, all right. Thank you so much, Will. How do people get in touch with you, get in touch with your campaign and support it?
Yeah, so you can go to my Facebook campaign page, or you can actually go to my personal page, and you can check out my personal page if you want to see kind of my day in and day out life. I don't mind you taking a look at that at all. I think we need to know more about our potential elected officials to make a good decision. But you can go to my personal Facebook page, and you can contact me. I will personally message you back, or you can go to Will Dismukes for statehouse88@gmail.com and email me, and I will be the one that emails you back.
All right. Well, thanks, Will. I appreciate so much you taking some time here. And I have to ask you one last final question, and this is going to be the most important one that we've covered today. Where do you stand on the Biscuits Millennial Night?
Hey, I think that is an awesome promotional idea, and people need to stop being so sensitive. I mean, come on, you know, it's like, I think it's
hilarious. You got to be able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah. I wish I could be there on the 21st.
And keep in mind, Will is a millennial just like me. So.
Yeah, I'll be there on Thursday night with my youth group next Thursday night. I wish I could be there on Saturday to chill at the, what is it, the what lounge is that, the selfie lounge or whatever?
Yeah, the selfie station and the napping station.
Yeah.
I'm holding them to that avocado promise. I want some
That's
guacamole.
Right. Gotta be there
at the Biscuits game. But anyway, Will Dismukes, he's running for office for the Alabama House of Representatives in District 88. Thank you so much for being with us. Yeah,
thank you.
All right. We'll be back in just a minute.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Governments could not give the rights essential to happiness. We claim them from a higher source, from the King of Kings and the Lord of all the earth, General John Dickinson, signer of the Constitution.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com, 860-1440 if you want to weigh in. And again, this is just one of those days where I feel like I could have 3 or 4 hours on the radio and I still wouldn't be able to cover everything. I wanted to go over Trey Gowdy, but the truth is we just do not have the time for it. It's already 10:40 and my time is short. I've still got to do the chaplain's report. So I'm not going to cover that right now. I am aware of it. I just, goodness knows, that was made for TV the other day. I mean, Gowdy going after Peter Strzok, it's brilliant. It's about 15 minutes long. I recommend you look it up on YouTube. I'm guessing Rush is going to be covering that, so I don't feel real bad about not talking about it. Rush is coming on, of course, directly after me, so be sure to get his take on that. I mean, Rush will, I'm sure, do it due justice. But since we don't have that much time, I wanted to mention just a couple of smaller stories from the other day. One thing that I thought was hysterical is that the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, you know Chris Cuomo, he's one of the guys there on CNN. He's a CNN news contributor. That's his brother. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, he goes on the other day and he's talking about, because the left is just absolutely freaking out about Brett Kavanaugh, which is funny because he's not that conservative a justice. I mean, again, I think that he's going to wind up being somewhere between, I think he's more conservative than Roberts. I think he's less conservative than Alito. That's just how I would place him based on the opinions and some of the people that are a lot smarter than me, legal minds that have been observing him, have said so far. But nonetheless, that has not stopped the left from going into full panic mode, thinking that it's another Neil Gorsuch, which goodness knows, I hope they're right. I hope that this is another Neil Gorsuch. That would be amazing if we got another Neil Gorsuch on the court. I just don't think that is reality. But nonetheless, the left has gone into full-on panic mode when it comes to this, and they're specifically citing that they're terrified of getting Roe v. Wade overturned. And because of this, Andrew Cuomo, who I always thought he was going to be the smarter of the two Cuomo brothers based on some of the things that Chris Cuomo has said, apparently it's kind of a dead heat for who can say the dumber thing in that household. But anyway, so Andrew Cuomo the other day said that he was going to sue the Supreme Court if they overturned Roe v. Wade. Yeah, I don't think you have to have a law degree from Harvard to understand why that's not going to work out too well. Because if you sue the court, then it's probably going to get appealed to a federal appeals court, and then that decision will be decided on ultimately if it gets appealed by the Supreme Court. So you would be suing the court that would presumably be making the decision on whether or not you're allowed to sue the court. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that is not going to go well for you. But hey, if you want to, if that happens, by all means, go ahead and do it, Andrew Cuomo. Waste millions of dollars in New York taxpayer money to try to get that overturned, which doesn't make any sense because, like I've said before, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, it goes back to the states. Now, this is part of the reason that I support a constitutional amendment that protects life, because I don't think that, as it stands right now, the Constitution allows for the federal government to do that. But my point in all of that is, when it comes to the Constitution, it wouldn't even be outlawed in New York if they overturn Roe v. Wade. I mean, New York is not going to all of a sudden have this massive red wave sweep over the state and then you know, the legislature would be outlawing Roe v. Wade within the span of 6 months. So I just don't see that happening. And this really goes back to something that I have been a believer on for a long time, is that nothing gets in the way of the left's agenda more than personal liberty. Personal liberty is the number one thing that stands in the way of liberalism. And this is something that goes back, because all conservatives are saying right now is we want an originalist. We want a not a conservative judge, a constitutional judge, a judge that is just going to follow the Constitution by the letter of the law, not put their political agenda forward, not vote for and be a voice for conservatism, just an originalist that sees the Constitution as it was originally intended to be written. That's all we're asking for. But that's something that is horrifying to the left, because they know that that is a giant impediment to getting their agenda through, because they don't like the Constitution, they don't want the Constitution. And part of that is because if you have people that are less dependent on government, because the more freedom you have, the less powerful the government is. As Ronald Reagan once astutely noted, when freedom increases, government decreases, and vice versa. So when people become less dependent on that big government, it's a lot harder to buy votes. And so that is a giant impediment to their agenda getting through. When people no longer rely on the government, then you can't say, well, you have to have the government for this, this, and this. It's a lot harder to buy off votes that way. And to kind of prove my point here, and the reason that the left is terrified of an originalist justice, this is a clip from MSNBC the other day, one of their anchors, Katie Turn, on originalism. Whoop, that wasn't it. Okay, here we go. Let's try this again. Katie Turr on originalism.
Based on where Americans stand on the issues, and Americans have really moved in a much more progressive direction over the years, do you think it's appropriate to continue to take such a strict originalist view of the Constitution, given it's 2018 and not 1776?
Okay, there are 100 things wrong with what she just said. First and foremost, yeah, the Constitution wasn't written in 1776. So if you were to interpret the Constitution according to the sensibilities of 1776, you actually would be incorrect. The Constitution was ratified in 1789. 1776 was the Declaration of Independence. Yes, people, these are the ones that are leading our country in the media. People that do not understand the Constitution was not written in 1776. But anyway, so that aside, that massive faux pas aside, when you ask, is it correct to understand it in the original context in which it was written? Yes. In fact, that's the way that every document, legal or non-legal, should be understood in every circumstance without exception. Now, I could go off in a diatribe about communication theory, because that's what my degree is in, but I'll give a short summary here. Essentially, when you're conveying a message, regardless of what that message is, you have the person that is sending the message and the message that they are trying to convey, the message that they are intending, and then they go forward with that and prescribe it onto a medium, whether that medium is their own voice, whether that medium is something that is written down, whether that medium is a computer, regardless of what it is, that message is conveyed by them on some form of some kind of medium, and then the person that is receiving that message interprets it. And when communication is going well, in other words, when communication is going correctly, it's when the receiver, the person that gets that message at the end, understands what the person that was originally sending the message was trying to convey. And there's a lot of things that can go wrong with this process. The person that's conveying the message may not be a very good communicator, and because of that, they convey a message other than what they intended. But the point is, when communication is operating the way that it is supposed to, and the way that it was intended, then you have to understand it in the context in which that person was conveying the message. In other words, to understand the message itself, you have to understand what they were originally intending to say. This idea that you can just retroactively say, well, the word would have meant this to the person that's writing this, but I think it should mean this, ergo we're going to look at it that way. Yeah, that's not the way that it works. You cannot imagine, well, what would our founders have done if they were living in 2018? It doesn't matter. They weren't living in 2018. They were living in the 1700s and the early 1800s. And so because of that, we have to understand what they were writing at the time. This is true of every historic document. Let's look at the Bible. the correct way to understand the Bible is to understand the context in which the author was writing and the audience he was sending it to at that time, how it would have been understood by people back then. Perfect example. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. You'll notice in the King James Version, it uses the word charity. Well, that's because the King James Version is a bad translation, right? No, it's not. The reason that charity was used is because people back when the original King James was transcribed in 1611, the word charity was understood to mean love. Over time, because people said, well, what do charitable people do? Well, they give to the poor. Over time, the meaning of the word charity changed. But you see, the original intention of the message, if you're to understand that chapter correctly, if you're reading it in the King James, is to understand how somebody reading it in 1611 would have done, and that will allow you to rightly understand the original message that was being conveyed, and that's why modern translations use the word love instead of charity. Understanding a document, any historic document, regardless of what it is, the Constitution, whether it's novels that were written in the past, the correct way to understand any document whatsoever is to understand it in the context in which the author intended. Doing anything else is just revisionist, and it defeats the purpose of writing anything down anyway. Because if they wanted you to understand things in the sense that you are a modern person and you have the modern sensibilities, they wouldn't bother writing it down. Because you can just come to those conclusions on your own whenever you're living. If we interpret the Constitution in such a way that we just read into it whatever we want based on our own modern ideas, then there was no point in ever writing a Constitution in the first place. And it also defeats the purpose of having a Supreme Court to interpret that Constitution. Because if the founders wanted us to just change based on the whims of public opinion, they would have just made us a direct democracy. When bills came up, we would all just vote on them. We wouldn't even have representatives. The idea that she is putting forward that we need to understand things, we need to read them from a 21st century perspective, is to completely nullify the entire purpose of the Constitution and the Supreme Court. But that's really what liberals want, because again, personal liberty, which the Constitution protects, is the number one impediment to getting their agenda done, and they know it, and that's why they want to water down the Constitution. 860-1440, Chaplain's Report is next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is talking here, and there were large crowds going along with him. This is in Luke 14:25-27. Now large crowds were going with him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brother and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Now, that sounds pretty harsh. And it is. But what Christ is saying there is not that he wants you to have discord with your brothers and sisters or your family, or that he wants all these terrible things to happen, but he's saying, if you're not willing to leave everything behind, even your most innocent desires, then you're not worthy of being my disciple. You're not worthy of following me and walking with me. That is a sobering thought. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.